What's happening, everybody? Welcome to the show. We are your hosts, Chase and Miles, and we are at the Lucky Duck. Welcome back, everybody. After a short hiatus in between some episodes, we are back, baby. And we are so excited because, Miles, who are we talking to today?
Today, I'm thrilled to introduce a dear friend. We've all shared many milestones together, from high school to college days filled with learning and growth. I had the privilege of getting to know him more as an adult when I lived near him and his amazing wife, Sherry, in Boston a few years ago. I learned that he's still a very kind and caring friend. Now he's making a profound impact as a therapist in Boston. Join me as we catch up and reminisce about our shared past. This is Shane.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Welcome, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep.
Cheers, guys. Yeah. Clankety, clankety.
We're drinking coffees because it's 3 a.m.
Yep.
Shane leaves at 5, so we had to...
Yeah.
We had to do this early.
We had to get it in a little early today, which is okay. Today's cocktail is an Irish coffee. You can catch what it looks like, how to make one, at our Instagram. And don't forget to follow us just across all the socials. And if you're listening, that's awesome. But if you want to watch the podcast too, we're on YouTube, so check us out there.
Really good looking, just saying. So
yeah, if you want to see beautiful people talk nonsense into the void... There's a lot on YouTube about that, but we particularly are the king of doing that.
Yeah, we do it the best.
So what's going on, Shane? How you been? What's new?
What's new? Got out of working with kids. I'm a therapist, you guys know that, right? Working with kids before, in the group setting. I was at a treatment center, and now I'm working at a prison, helping inmates. So,
whoa, when you say working at a prison.
Is that because you're in prison too?
Yeah.
Kind of.
You on leave?
Sometimes I'm in prison. I'm in prison at work, and I'm at prison sometimes at home.
Yeah, right. So let's rewind a little bit. You are a therapist. That's sort of your background in education. When did you know you wanted to become a therapist?
Okay. That's a good question. When did I know? I kind of struggled a little bit, figuring out early on, what I think a lot of us do, right? We struggle kind of figuring out what we want to do and kind of what career path we're going to choose. We have an idea in high school and then it changes and go to college and it's completely different, right? And that was my route too. And when I was in college, I think you guys know I was pre-med. That was kind of my idea. I knew I wanted to help people. That changed because I was okay, one, it's too expensive, and two, I don't know if I'm gonna enjoy it as much.
People suck.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Right. Miles, I think you were pre-med too at one point.
I was, yeah.
Yeah. I still knew I wanted to help people after graduating. And I was thinking about it and, I was what do I want to do? I took a 3-year hiatus after college and I was what the hell am I going to do? I kept thinking about it. I was therapy sounds like a good idea. And at that time, a lot of mass shootings were happening, Stoneman Douglas High School, the Jason Aldean concert. I think even Orlando at the time might have been in that area too when I was taking that hiatus. And I was I want to work with kids. I want to actually help out those kids that, are terrified of going to school and might be being bullied quite a bit and that's kind of how I got into it, so
nice. What is the what is the education track after, say, for your, in your instance, you ended up graduating with like a bachelor's degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what does it look like if you decide after that, that you're like, hey, I'm going to become a therapist. What does that look like?
So the route to becoming a therapist kind of thing, like education wise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously bachelor's degree, you could pretty much get a bachelor's degree, and just about anything. You don't necessarily have to major in psychology with a bachelor's. I majored in exercise science, which was a pre-med route, but going the master's route, it's a 2-3 year program, sometimes 4 if you're part-time. You'd get a master's in clinical mental health counseling. That's where what I got. And yeah, you kind of just do that for, you don't have to specialize, but then post-grad, you do kind of like a residency kind of situation where it's like 2 years, where you're working unlicensed and you're trying to gain clinical hours,
to become licensed.
Exactly. So, and then, you know, once you get licensed, your options open up, you can kind of pretty much do anything, but until you're licensed, like it's a long time. A little bit.
You know, like I feel like medical doctors always talk about, oh, I'm not in my career till I'm like 40 something, mm-hmm. right? It's like you go to this because you did 4 years of bachelor's, you did a couple years of the master's, and do a couple years of residency like training, and then now you're certified.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that you can go help people.
It's kind of similar. Yeah. A little bit in that way. Yeah. So, and yeah, it's something I definitely want to continue doing, and I don't see myself doing anything else really.
So when you finished your master's and started working, you were working with kids first?
Yes.
And then, so what changed since then? Now you're working with prisoners.
Well, I wanted to branch out first. All I did was work with kids originally in a certain setting, which is considered a partial hospitalization program. So
explain what that means.
So a partial hospitalization program is actually, you have different types of care within the mental health field, right? Like when you go to therapy, most people think, you're sitting down one-on-one with a therapist, right? Whereas like there's different higher levels of therapy from that. That's like your baseline of therapy. And then higher than that, if you need like additional services, you'd go like, there's inpatient, right? Which is like, sometimes if you like need hospitalization, say like, you know, you're having thoughts of suicide and like you need more care, right? Like you actually have like a plan, you have intent to carry that out. Like you need, going inpatient, right? Which is that, and then residential. So inpatient is like short term, high level care. Residential's longer term, higher level of care, where you're staying the night at these places, right? Where hospital or even like a community where you're like doing group, you're doing activities, you're doing a lot of treatment. And then that's the high level. That's the highest level. And then to step down from that would be PHP, partial hospitalization program.
Hmm.
So it's a day program. And then it's basically like you do groups, with the kids for like 6 hours during the day. And then they go home at night, and then they're still home on the weekends. So that's kind of how that is. And then from PHP down, would be like the baseline level where you're seeing a therapist, where you're seeing one-to-one, right?
Yeah. Is that something you would do? Like a one-on-one thing, or are you more in the group setting? Cause I know you talked about before wanting to like do the kind of therapy where you take kids out on trips, so camping, to be in nature, be around animals, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of playing around a little bit, right? With the being at the prison now. I'm kind of like doing it something different because that's all I did was PHP, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm trying something different, but yeah, doing something like individual. I got into groups originally because I wanted to do the wilderness thing, take groups out, do group more, therapy and gain those skills. But now I've got those skills. Now it's like, all right, what's next kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
tell me more about what groups actually entails.
Like what does group therapy look like kind of thing? Or
yeah, you'd mention, you know, like there could be like in the PHP type of thing, there could be like a 6-hour group session or something to that effect. What exactly happens during that?
Oh, okay. Okay. So sorry. Yeah, I might have, so the structure of a group, so typically like it depends on the facility running it, honestly. My internship that I did, we only did 3 groups a day and it was for like 45 minutes each. Whereas the last place I went to, we did groups for 1.5 hours and that was 4 groups a day. Which is long. But in the structure of that, we kind of do different things. So, like maybe we'll do like a psychotherapy group where it's mostly talking, right? Where it's kind of like not digging deep into trauma, but it's like surface level trauma. And it's kind of like everyone's being supportive. So as a therapist in a group setting, we're mostly a moderator. We're kind of like helping the discussion flow, but we're not trying to change the discussion unless it gets inappropriate, obviously. Hmm. But, you know, we're trying to help guide that conversation, keeping it therapeutic and keeping everyone engaged and like trying to facilitate more of a therapeutic conversation. But in the structure of that, right, is psychotherapy, expressive therapy. It could be drama therapy. It could be expressive therapy. I did a lot of expressive therapy with the kids.
Is that just when like they tell you how they're feeling?
Oh,
what exactly is that?
Yeah, great question. Sorry, jargon, right?
That's okay.
In terms of yeah, what that looks like, it could be like art related, it could be music related. So they're like doing like activities using a medium to kind of help understand underlying what they're kind of feeling or how they're thinking, or maybe something that they're not even aware of subconsciously. And it's kind of like starting to come to the surface through that medium. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So
that's really cool. Are a lot of these kids here voluntarily, or their parents are sending them, or the state sending them, or whatever?
Most of the time, I mean, it is a volunteer program for PHP. But yeah, parents help with the kids in getting them to, you know, the sessions or even just being a part of the day program. But most of the time, like the kids, obviously in a new setting like that, it's hard, right? Being in that age, really any age, and going into a new setting, a new kind of like thinking, you know, being with kids that maybe, you know, if I was a kid going into that situation, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I don't know anyone here. Like, you know, I am having all these problems. Are they going to accept me? That kind of thing.
Now it's like adding another layer to the social problems.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do kids usually get over that?
Honestly, by doing the program, just actually helps. Like, right, it teaches you, hey, I'm going into a group setting. You know, I'm having a lot of anxiety about this, right? Socially. And if I, you know, if they can, after, you know, a while of doing it, actually participating in the groups, talking to the other kids, finding those connections, then that anxiety goes away, right? And it like teaches you, hey, this isn't like gonna hurt me. Like, mm-hmm. if that makes sense, because we teach anxiety like anxiety like is a protective factor, right? At least that's how it is when it comes to like psychology.
Yeah.
In terms of like
meaning it's a natural response from your body about things that it thinks are like dangerous or
unknown.
That you should, yeah, exactly. Unknown. Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah, that's always a weird thing. I remember talking to someone once, them explaining to me like, oh, the way you feel, it's a good thing, but not necessarily if you're feeling it too much, I guess, right? So you have to get that kind of like a good level of having it, but not to the degree that it's harmful, I guess.
Yeah, and that's when it can develop into a disorder, when it becomes too much and harmful and
What defines a disorder, like something like an anxiety disorder?
When it comes to like diagnosing someone, right? Everyone says like, oh, you know, diagnose me. I have, you know, what do I have, you know, as a therapist?
What's wrong
like
with that. Me? Yeah, right. There's something got to be wrong with me. I'm not normal. Right,
exactly.
Yeah.
It really comes down to like, we look at functional impairment, which means like, how much is this affecting you on a daily basis? Like, are you able to go to work? Are you able to go to school? Are you able to get dressed in the morning? Are you, is it limiting your ability to socialize with people, right? Like agoraphobia, right? Like if that's, then that's within the vein of anxiety, right?
What exactly is that?
So that's the fear of, I don't know the exact definition off the top of my head, but it's basically like, I'll give you an example. Someone can't like leave their house for anything.
Okay.
Like,
cause they're too anxious.
I've seen movies about this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And, right. That anxiety builds and it becomes like, feels like a protective factor and yeah. And it becomes full blown disorder. If it's like, they're unable to go out and get the groceries. Right. Right. So then they can't eat as much or as maybe nutritious meals, right? They can't call someone, right? Or they can't, you know, it depends, right, on what the exact disorder is, but how much is it limiting their ability to complete daily tasks, right? Activities of daily living, that's what we call it. So
is this kind of like what people say autism, there's like a spectrum or are they really separate disorders that people have?
Yeah, so there are separate disorders. So anxiety is in a different class of disorders than say autism. Autism's more of a neurodevelomental disorder. But I mean
the level of anxiety, I guess, like someone who has, what did you call it? Agoraphobia,
yeah.
Versus like someone who has panic attacks every day or something like that. Are those kind of the same disorder or are they're actually different ways with how your brain's working or whatever?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So they're a good question. Yeah. So like agoraphobia and panic attacks, those are both right. Yes. Within the same like vein as anxiety.
Okay.
But yeah, it's they're both different in how I guess they're impacting the person. Someone with panic disorders could have panic disorders and unable to really identify the triggers, whereas agoraphobia is more of like you can tell that like there's a social aspect to it, right? Maybe someone's diagnosed with panic disorders in the beginning, but maybe that does change to agoraphobia once we realize what the triggers are, right? Or, you know, panic attacks, someone's originally diagnosed with that. And then, you know, we find something else like, you know, they're diagnosed really as, you know, having depression, you know, sometimes anxiety and depression can kind of look similar, and we have to kind of like figure out which one's which. So,
and what how do you do that? Like what really is anxiety versus depression?
Anxiety can be like, we look at more symptoms. So like there's a little bit of an overlap with symptoms in terms of depression and anxiety, and that's why they look similar. So like depression, I mean, everyone thinks about it and the classic example of like, you know, you can't get out of bed in the morning, right? You can't get dressed, that kind of thing. Sleep disturbances, right? Irritability, like that can be a sign of depression that actually not a lot of people think about and know about. Mm-hmm. And then also, that's also, you know, irritability also carries over to anxiety. Sleep disturbances carry over to anxiety, right? So it's kind of like the symptoms, which one fits more the bill kind of thing. So we kind of just have to talk more with the client more than anything, and kind of figure out like which fits more. So
when someone describes to you someone who's depressed or has an anxiety disorder, when they are describing it to you, the way it feels, not just like the, I can't sleep or I feel like I'm just sad or things like that, the actual feeling of it, do anxiety and depression feel the same to people? Or when they start talking about how they actually feel, can you delineate them at that point?
It depends. Like, we're with clients for such a short period of time in that setting. We only see them for maybe a month, you know? So, and we're only having individual sessions once a week, right? But we're doing group sessions as well in that PHP setting, right? So, like, it's hard to, unless you have someone long-term who you're with, doing therapy with one-on-one for, like, a year or two, then you can really understand, you know, if it's anxiety or depression. A lot of the times, because we have such a quick, like, we have to diagnose people in the community, like almost like immediately with a bio, what's called a biopsychosocial. It's kind of like you get all the pertinent information related to their treatment. And you have to diagnose them with something in order to meet the requirements of the insurance to be covered, right? There has to be something that is stating like they need treatment, they need care, they can't function within the community.
Have you ever had an example where you got this sheet with information and you're like, this person, I can't label them with anything. Where you're just like, yeah, you just don't fit any of these, you know, schemas that are, you know, that I've been given to throw you in. I can't put you in a bucket with other people because it just doesn't fit. And then they get rejected. Is that how it works?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or they're just paying out of pocket if they want to continue treatment regardless.
They can do that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have had clients before where they didn't fit. They didn't fit a certain thing, or really like insurance looks at certain diagnoses and determines what is like
that they need to cover versus right. Not.
Yeah. Like, so some people will be diagnosed with depression or anxiety, but really they have like conduct disorder, and you can't bill for a conduct disorder, so you have to label them with something else.
What is conduct disorder?
Conduct disorder is kind of like you don't have you're not good with authorities. So like you're not going to listen to authorities that much, right?
I feel like I have a little bit of that.
To a degree though, that it's like it is impairing you.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And what causes that?
I couldn't tell you what the cause. Yeah. I mean, like,
what causes anything, really?
Yeah. I mean, in my kind of experience with things, with the few cases that I have worked with conduct disorder, I mean, every person's upbringing is going to be different, but it's how you, I mean, it's very few cases that I've had conduct disorder, but like they just haven't been told no, you know. There's a lot of you know what I mean,
silver spoon type kind upbringing,
a little bit
nature versus nurture. Yeah. What have you ever gotten to an example where, you know, you're like, I can't diagnose you with anything? They're like, come on, man. Like, I need my insurance to cover me. Like, just give me like something. Give me like anxiety disorder or something like that.
Yeah, pretty kind of like that. I mean, I won't word it like that. Yeah. I'll be like, hey, like, you know, what is hard for you on a daily basis? You know, and kind of leave it more open questions with, you know, clients to kind of because that could be, you know, fraudulent too.
Yeah, you don't want to.
So like trying to help them to get help, but you're not just writing something down that they don't actually have.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So as long as it's like they're meeting the criteria, like then we give them that label. But if they're not, then we have to give them, you know, and they're not meeting any, they're not giving you any information really related to what, you know, we think might be going on, then we can't label them with anxiety or depression. We have to give them, you know, this, this diagnosis, which probably won't be covered by insurance, and that's okay. Yeah. But, you know, it's at that point, like, you know, where can we give them the resources after that, that maybe could help them, like, in, you know, in the community.
What's the most common diagnosis that you've seen in the last few years of your work?
Really, it's been anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. Just because it's so,
it covers a lot.
It does. Yeah. And it's, but I've worked with, you know, bipolar disorder 1 and 2. I've worked
one with, and two. What's the difference?
So 1 and 2 is, 2's a little less serious. Well, they're both serious, but like 2 is different, where it's, 1 is the classic example that you kind of see, like, that you know of, where it's the manic episodes and then the depressive episodes, you know, the very high highs and the very low lows.
Yeah.
So.
Gotcha.
And then bipolar 2 is a little less than that. So, like, if you want to think of, like, bipolar 1 is like these big dips and peaks,
yeah,
whereas, and then bipolar 2 is more of like, they're a little less,
like little hills.
Yeah.
So someone with bipolar 2 may not need to take medication to help them, maybe like when they're having an episode or something.
They may not. Mm. Sometimes depends. It really depends. So
like, how would you treat them differently?
Honestly, with 2, it might be a little bit more of giving them psychoeducation around, like, their, you know, what they're experiencing, and kind of, cause a lot of people with bipolar disorder don't believe, you know, that, well, I wouldn't say all of them, but like, it's bipolar disorder 2 is kind of like, it's hard to recognize, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, because the dips and peaks are so, like, not as you know, prevalent as bipolar 1. So it's giving them more psychoeducation in that regard,
so that they could recognize it and
right
somehow live with it.
Exactly. Kind of, yeah, it's more of recognizing it. So, yeah, I didn't mean to say that they don't believe it, but yeah,
but they don't know, right? Is that what you're saying? Like, they don't know they have it, but they know something's kind of like weird about
it. It's normal to them. Normal. Right, it's like I mean with anyone with really a disorder, it's like,
because you don't know anything different,
right? It's how exactly you are. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's that's what it, yeah, that's
yeah,
how they live their life, their entire life, and you know, they don't know anything different, right?
So now, going to prisoners versus working with the kids, is it kind of different, or is it really the same? Yeah,
it is different.
It is.
Yeah, it's same. It's the same in some regards, in terms of I don't know what I'm doing clinically. A lot of the thing is, I work with the male population. So,
and are these like murderers? Are they, yeah, like it could be anything. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Murderers, substance, drug charges. It could be really anything. But it's a medium security prison. So like,
no cannibals or anything like that.
I don't know. We'll see. I don't like to look at, I like to try and stay impartial as much as I can. But yeah, it is different in terms of like, it's the same in terms of like the clinical, approaches that I do. But it's different in terms of like, guys there don't want to seem like, I guess, they're quote unquote weak by using mental health services, or even culturally, you know, that male stigma. Mm-hmm. Of like, you know, going and seeking help, and that's, you know, that's tough, right? Like, because if they, you know, if they're seen doing that, especially in prison, like, you become a target. You become someone who is easily manipulatable, or you know, vulnerable.
Yeah. Right. Well, I know this is a TV show, but that's basically what the Sopranos is about, right?
Yeah. Yeah, basically. Yeah, it's centered around the idea of a mafia boss going into therapy, talking about his problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you have a way for some prisoners to do it kind of like secretively so that other prisoners don't know, or do they have to?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. We in terms of like scheduling clients, we code it as like a medical appointment versus a mental health appointment.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Sneaky. So. Do people know you as the therapist or do they not?
They definitely know. They know when there's a new employee there. They know, you know, everything, because that's all they have to do, right?
Yeah, like, it's a small world for them.
One of the only connections they have to the outside world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And so you're working with the male population. Would it be prohibited for you to work with the female population?
No.
Okay. No. I didn't know if it was like gender specific or something to that effect.
No. I think there's before me at my site, there was a lot more, you know, in my field, actually, there's a lot more, there's more female clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
Male clinicians are kind of rare nowadays. Before it wasn't like that. But so my site was really targeting more to hire more males, and that's kind of like how I got in there. But yeah, there's male clinicians working at the female prisons.
Do you know why that is, that there's not as many males these days?
I don't. I think it's, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I think it's, I don't know. It's just
happened. Yeah.
Something you observed.
I really can't tell you. Yeah. I don't really know the reason behind that. Yeah.
Do you, when you treat, diagnose or whatever, men versus women, are there different methods? I mean, you know, you talked about like some men have the whole, like, I guess the macho of like, I shouldn't seek help or whatever. But beyond that, is there anything different you really do between men and women?
Not necessarily. Well, I guess I'd say this. If a man is coming to therapy, I try to, I guess, cater to them a little bit more just because of the macho, like, kind of like mentality that you're referring to. Because if a man is reaching out for help, more than likely, like, that might be their first time ever seeking therapy, or like that might be the only like time where they're asking for help. Because if they have a bad experience that one time that they're reaching out for help with therapy, they might not ever do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, females tend to reach out more or more often. It's just that social construct, right, that's been created. It's mm-hmm. nothing in you know, some men are different and then some females are different, right? It's not a generalization. I'm not trying to make that, but that's that's kind of what I see.
Oh yeah, so that's, you hear about it, people talk about that construct, but in the actual practice of therapy, you've actually seen that exist in
absolutely.
Real life. Really?
Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Interesting. A lot. Yeah.
When you're working with kids, what was like the age group that you were working? Because obviously now, like going to prison, you know, that age group can swing wild from like 18 to, you know, 90-year-old
absolutely.
Being in prison. So, so what was the age group of the kids that you're treating, and how has it been adapting to, you know, speaking with kids versus speaking with grown men in the therapy setting?
Yeah. Speaking with kids, and the age group that I was working with was age 12 all the way up to 18. So we had, and that's a, I know that's like a, like shorter range, I guess, but in developmental years, right, that's huge, you know. And 12 versus 18 is going to, you know, be huge, but
is that is that the age group that you want to be working within, like long term, like the teenager type years?
Yeah, I'd say 13 to 18 and like in one kind of like group, and then like also young adults probably up to like, I don't know, 28 or something in another group kind of thing, like separation of using those therapy groups type, you know. So, but yeah, talking with them, talking with a 12-year-old is obviously going to be different compared to, you know, a 16-year-old. You know, a 16-year-old might have more experience with using substances to cope with how they're feeling, whereas a 12-year-old isn't. Maybe they're going to be, maybe a 12-year-old is going to be using video games a lot more to cope, right? You know, and they're using different things, right? And it's just you're going to, and you know, a 16-year-old is going to have different life experiences. You know, they're all rooted within this, in kind of like the same symptomology, right, with a disorder, if they have one. But you know, the different experiences that they have, you know, and we would talk about, and you know, we try to make it inclusive as much as possible. So like, you know, running drug groups even with the younger kids, because that's not advocating for drug use, but like, what's the terminology I used? Giving them, what's the word? More of along the lines of like harm reduction. That's what it is. So like, all right, what's a cigarette? Like, what does a vape look like? How much nicotine is in a vape, right? Versus a cigarette. Like, letting them know, like, what is more harmful. We're not going to let, you know, we're not going to be there to, you know, stop you from taking a cigarette or a vape. Mm-hmm. But we can at least tell you, like, you know, inform you of
the risks.
Right, involved, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And not trying to scare them. Yeah. Right, because the DARE program,
what are your thoughts on that?
it was a good idea at the time. I think it was the best idea at the time, but in terms of like making effective change, I think it was, you know, a scare tactic. It was, you know, that really didn't work, and kind of like as maybe unorthodox, maybe as it might seem now, you know, telling a kid, a 12-year-old, hey, this is what a vape looks like, and this is, you know, how you use it and things like that, might be, you know, a little not, you know, unorthodox, like I said, like, mm-hmm. it's letting them know, it's letting them know what it does look like, right, in mm-hmm. order for them to make that choice,
yeah,
on whether or not they are going to take it or not,
because mm-hmm. right? They're not going to just, you could be like, hey, don't do that. They're not going to be like, oh, my therapist told me not to do it,
right?
So.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I think there's sense. I think there's a lot of studies on how that is more effective than the scare tactic type of thing, and I've actually recently seen something come out, particular to Colorado, that since the legalization of marijuana, that teen marijuana use has gone down mm-hmm. in like schools and all that.
You think so?
That's what the studies are saying. Yeah. Mm. And so they're saying by making it, less of a illegal, like scary thing, and in educating them about it and making it more of a clinical type of thing, mm-hmm. That they've I guess not stopped using it, but there's less of it being used.
Yeah,
or maybe they're just really good at hiding it, and whoever's doing these studies did not pick up on that. What you're saying, that's what it reminded me of. It was just a kind of a real world example of something I've seen recently in the news.
Absolutely. And honestly, like, I think the more education we can have around like substances, the more we can be prepared to handle them, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's you're a parent or you're a, you know, a scientist doing the research, you know. I think this is my personal opinion just from, you know, what I've seen in therapy, but from a clinical lens, but like informing the kids before they make the decision. They're going to be the ones to make the decision. You can't control that. But yeah,
I would kind of expect not necessarily a reduction in use of like nicotine, tobacco, marijuana, or whatever, but maybe like more responsible use of it, I guess, or like purchasing,
Yeah. Listen, I mean, some of it, it's an interesting thing to think about. Like, just a few short years ago, we had, what were those nicotine pens? Jewels.
Jewels. Mm. Yeah.
You know, and like those became super popular, and like everybody was, you know, a lot of kids were using Jewels, and they had to shut it down. Mm-hmm. Because of that, and now you have, what's those nicotine pouches, Zins. Those are like really popular now.
It's like the dipless dip, basically. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Tobacco. You still put it in your mouth, I think,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's just like just a nicotine pouch.
Right.
Which like, you know, listen, like whatever floats your boat, but, there is something about having something mainstream and easily available that could actually increase teen use over, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to know a little bit more about that. You know, what is the most effective approach to make something safe to use and available and safe to procure. Mm-hmm. Like for the example of marijuana, like making marijuana legalized probably cuts out the illegal activity, which makes it a lot safer to consume it if you are going to use it. But at the same time, you know, talking and kind of shifting the conversation to Juul, that was super accessible and easy to get. And it did, you know, cause a rise of nicotine use and nicotine addiction in teens, right?
Yeah.
So what's the right approach to making something safe to use, safe to get, and not have an epidemic on your hands, right? Essentially, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing too with the legalization of marijuana. I don't want to talk about that. There are actually a lot of positives to it, but it has been easily more accessible to teens.
Yeah.
And a lot of teens are using it to cope with anxiety too, mm-hmm. right? So like, sure. And then that develops a pattern of habit, right? But I think too that there is a good thing. I think I haven't done research on this yet, but I think, I mean, just from looking at fentanyl and how bad it's been, right? I think it's cleaned up, like the fact that marijuana has been legalized. That's taken fentanyl away from being put in the illegal side of selling marijuana, right?
Oh yeah, right.
So like you have a clean product, right? Mm-hmm. A clean, you know, you don't have fentanyl that's in there or any other drug that might be mixed in. I mean, there's still like, it's still possible with teens because they're not getting it directly from the dispensary, right? They're getting it from a different source, but you have those. You know, there's less of a chance for it to be, laced with something, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that is one positive, right? Just to look at harm reduction, because that's what I try to look at with working with clients. How do we try to, you know, obviously you don't want someone on substances to be relying on it all the time to help them with symptoms, but how do we get them maybe a little like using it less or like, you know, and using other clinical interventions instead for, you know, until they can eventually maybe, you know, use other ways of coping that are healthy, right? Mm-hmm. Like going for a run or, you know, talking to a friend or, using a physical skill like breathing exercises, right? So
do you think those kind of therapies are more short term though? Like you might see a kid and teach him some of those things and he might do them and say, hey, I feel good. Like I've been running. I haven't been vaping or whatever. Like it's when I'm feeling whatever way, it helps me feel better. But then they stop seeing you. months go by, running takes effort. You got to get out and run, or going to the gym takes effort. You got to go there. And then you kind of get back into like, oh, I can just like smoke marijuana or sit in my bed and play video games or something.
Yeah. I mean, that happens. I mean, it happens to, you know, even therapists, know, like we know these skills, we know how to use them and apply them, but, you know, using them in our own lives is also very tough. And yeah, you work with a client and you can show them all the skills and teach them everything and they're doing well for a while under your care. But then, you know, right. Even during care, they could fall off, or, you know, after care, they could fall off. And like, right. Just life circumstances that pop up can just be debilitating to the point where they, you know, everything goes right out the window and they rely on older methods of coping, right?
So this is kind of like the idea of like AA, right? So AA is a program where you like go every week and you're with your peers. And so you're always kind of in that thought of like, hey, this is why I shouldn't do those things. And you're kind of coping in a different way. And it's not something that costs money. So you're not having to spend money. And I think that's like the type of program that kind of keeps that going, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's into like people in AA are making, even though they might relapse, they're still making that conscious choice to like, I want to be sober. Like I you know, this thing is not helping me. And I know I need to change something about this thing that, isn't helping me. What can I do? So going to AA meetings, building that structure, building that routine, building, you know, community of people who might be suffering in the same way, is going to help them really try to, you know, kick that habit. Or
yeah. Like what you can give them all the information on how to do that. What's like the one piece of advice that you can give patients to be motivated to actually do it and practice what, you know, you preach?
To motivate them. I mean, a lot of the times I pick up on their strengths. So everyone has strengths, whether you think you do or don't. Like every single person has a certain strength about them and how they approach life or approach their own way of, just existing. And I try to like highlight those things, right? And that gives them a lot of motivation. Like say for instance, like you're really good at telling people no or keeping boundaries with other people, right? You know, how can we incorporate that maybe more into their treatment, right? Into like, or maybe, you know, we work on the skills to, that they're not, maybe so good at. Maybe they're not good at keeping boundaries. So we use that, but in tandem, we focus on the strengths. Like, how can you use your strengths in that skill that you're not typically good at and like weave it in, right? So like, and address maybe the concerns that they're having in their life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. I think, especially with people with depression, that may be like the hardest thing to overcome, right? Is like finding the willpower and the motivation to get better. You know, it's one thing to be medicated and that may help in some regard, but I'm sure a large majority of getting better requires, you know, the actual motivation to do something about it for yourself. Right. And so yes. I could see that being like a biggest obstacle for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Finding the willpower to get out of bed, finding the willpower to get dressed, go do something, or, you know, go grocery shopping, go see friends. Yeah. It's interesting to me. So you're working with kids age 12 to 18, the teenage years, the formative years. And so now you're working with inmates. And so what's been the hardest challenge so far going into that space?
The hardest challenge has been kind of a lot. COVID kind of disrupted a lot of like the whole in like institution in a way where it's like it put a lot of things on hold and there's not a whole lot of programs or resources available to incarcerated individuals. So we right now are basically operating under kind of like a limited capacity in what we're doing in terms of therapy. So for instance, like we're doing the one-on-one contacts, you know, therapy, but we're not doing, and we're doing like the crisis shifts, which is like responding to someone who maybe, you know, has thoughts of wanting to kill themselves or actually acting upon them in some way. Mm-hmm. That's the crisis shift. There's more to it than that, but those are like the two things that we're doing. So we're not doing implementing like group stuff and things like that to kind of build that community. Mm-hmm. Right. 'Cause like at the end of the day, like incarcerated individuals are people. Like they're people, like, you know, they may have done something, but they have needs too. They have like, they're just like us. They just, you know, may have acted upon emotions or behaviors that didn't, they were impulsive or, yeah, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, that stinks. COVID, you know, with COVID happening, it just disrupted a lot of that.
So it was different than the way it is right now before COVID?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. There was more programs. There was, you know, I think there was more group activities, things like that. So like the therapy side of things doesn't feel, this could just be a site thing, but you know, because I'm still new to the field, right? Mm-hmm. I've only been working in the field for 2 years now, something like that. So 2.5, yeah. Yeah, there's so I'm learning as I go. There's a lot I'm still learning. Every day I'm learning something new. Every day. It doesn't matter. If you're fresh out of grad school too, or you're you know, going later, like you've been in the field for 30 years, like you're still learning something every day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just in terms of working with incarcerated individuals, I'm just you know, trying to keep my boundaries, obviously, because you need to know what kind of population you're working with, but also trying to give them that the treatment that they deserve. Mm-hmm. You know, that they need. And you know, that's what I'm hoping to do in this setting, at least. You know,
have you ever, so like with kids, you were a kid, you were their age once, you may have had problems they had at some point. But with like a 60-year-old guy in prison, there's parts of life that maybe you haven't experienced. Mm-hmm. Or even with kids, like the experiences they've gone through that you didn't go through or whatever. Do you find it harder to work with those people? Or it's kind of the same as if you were to work with someone that you may be able to connect with more?
I think it's the same. I think it's maybe a little bit harder. Well, you have sympathy for, you know, as a therapist, I try to put myself in their shoes all the time, right? The person across from you, you try to see their life and how they're approaching it, how it's impacted them, all that, right? And I'd say it's actually harder when we have counter transference. So there's transference, right, which is client and how they're affecting you, right? Is that right? I might get that wrong, but counter transference is kind of like whatever the client is saying is impacting you, and it might strike a chord with something you've experienced in your life. Mm-hmm. And it might be harder to do therapy, say like someone has a similar traumatic experience as you, and you're there as the therapist trying to work with them, but it's like all these emotions and memories are popping up, and you actually your boundaries start slipping, right? And then you, and then you're like, oh no, like I'm not doing therapy anymore and I'm talking to this person like a friend.
Wow.
So, you know what I mean? So yeah. That's where it can become harder. Whereas it's easier to kind of keep yourself a little disconnected if it's like something that isn't, maybe experience that isn't as relatable. So,
yeah. So on that topic, does it affect you quite a bit, being with these people all the time?
Like in what regards? Like, what do you mean?
Like mental health wise.
Oh, mental health wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that it's in a more negative or a more positive way?
I say it's in probably a more positive way. Obviously, there's a mental toll when you're doing therapy. You know, this secondhand trauma, right? Like, that's a real thing. Like, you know, being with a client, hearing what they have to say, imagining yourself in the trauma that they experienced, and just visualizing that in your mind all day sometimes, that can be, it's exhausting. And that's why at the end of the day, you know, I'm not doing anything physical, but I'm just exhausted from just keeping that space. And I think over time you gain that stamina. And as long as you're talking about it in supervision, you know, it's doable. Yeah.
Do you think we have a mental health crisis in America?
In what way? Like, I think mental health is becoming more vocalized. Becoming less stigmatized. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's so much as a crisis as much as it is maybe people are talking about it more. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What did you kind of mean by that?
Yeah, I think I've seen it become more of a talking point that people bring up about, you know, increase in homeless issues in our big cities. And that's largely attributed to some mental health issues in mm-hmm. our population. People who can't get help, people who are abandoned by their families, you know, they often find themselves homeless. They can't take care of themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because of one thing or another. And usually that can all be back attributed to mental health issues. Yeah. I don't know. It's just something that I've noticed people talk. It's like one of those regurgitated points to say that, you know, America's in a mental health crisis. And so I think what you just said makes sense to me. I don't know how you can quantify it without doing some sort of like large study. I'm sure there's something out there that we could reference, but it seems to me that the more transparent and connected we are, even globally, the more I think you'd see things that we didn't see before. Mm-hmm. And maybe people are actually talking about their mental health issues more than they were in the past, because as a society, we're trying to destigmatize some of these things like mental health. You know, right. The Miles brought up the example of the Sopranos. Like it still is, you know, in a lot of ways, it's very taboo for somebody like that to go seek therapy, seek help, because in the past it's seen or it was portrayed as a sign of weakness, right? And so, yeah, maybe it is just that. Maybe we're just having a wider lens into what's always existed, which is the human condition, you know?
Yeah.
And the kind of, you know, diversity of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I don't know, there's so many studies out there, right, on saying that, like, you brought up, like, world connectivity, right, mm-hmm. and how we're talking more, but we're also spending more time on, you know, technology, right, and a lot of people attribute that to, you know, not socializing or not engaging in other things, right, out of life besides using your phone or using some sort of technology, right? But, you know, looking back through history, like, you know, when the TV came out, right, You know, the newspaper came out, you know, like people were still using these things and distracting themselves from, you know, interacting socially, right? You know, throughout history, I'm sure we could find more examples, but that's one argument too. You know, I can't say which one's right or which one's wrong. I don't, right. The studies that are coming out, there's one saying, yes, technology is causing all of this harm to, you know, kids.
Like and, social media specifically, right. Maybe.
And there are, right. I'm not saying that it isn't, right. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, cause you've got Instagram filters and stuff like that, that are changing how we look and like causing, you know, a stereotypical look for, you know, females or males. Right. And then that can become like when a, you know, a 13-year-old girl or even boy looks at, you know, body image, that could develop into body dysmorphia. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you could develop into an eating disorder, yeah, potentially. Right.
But, yeah, I think it was recently Facebook got in trouble for suppressing studies showing that, you know, social media use, specifically Instagram and Facebook, were actually causing some harm to specifically the younger teenage age group of like females, I think it was.
I think there was a whistleblower or something, because they do these internal studies and they collect different amounts.
Well,
of data
they want to do it so they look like they're making an effort to ensuring that their platforms are safe to use, specifically for those age groups, right? And so like, no, we've done the research. Right. It's fine. Don't look any further. Yeah. Like, please.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on that specifically? Like when it comes to social media, do you think, you know, do you think it is safe to use, or is it a good idea for teenagers to use in terms of like the impact it may have on their mental health?
I think it's everything, it's got good and bad qualities to it, right? You know, I can't argue for it being bad or being good. That's just there's a balance to everything, right? And I think with social media right now, like I'm sure you guys see it too, it's like the wild wild west. You know, there's obviously it's a little bit more regulated than it was, you know, back when like MySpace was around, going back a little bit, but, you know, back then it was really the wild, wild west, but you know, it's like, we're figuring this stuff out. And I think, you know, certain companies might, you know, take, maybe, you know, not on purpose, but try to take advantage of certain things that are allotted to them that hasn't been really figured out yet. You know,
I think it's in the best interest of these companies to do that due diligence and figure this out, because, you know, they want long-term success for these platforms. So it may come out that, you know, TikTok is so super detrimental to your health, and, you know, and suddenly now everybody's like, fuck TikTok or whatever. So they want to make sure that they're doing something to like actively, you know, understand the implications of use, but like overuse as well. Like, I don't know. I've seen my wife uses TikTok, and they have like some features that you can apply to it. Like, if after you've been scrolling for 10 minutes in a row, it'll like prompt you like, hey, what's going on? You know, like you have to put in like a little passcode.
Yeah.
So it reminds you, so you don't get into what's called doom scrolling, right? Just endless, just mindless scrolling. And then suddenly you look up and you're like, oh shit, I've been doing this for an hour. Like, where did the time go?
Right.
And your brain's all mushy.
A lot of industries have those, like gambling, you can like call casinos or casino groups and be like, I'm an addict, don't let me in, right? Which isn't 100% effective, but or like cigarettes have warnings on them, alcohol have warnings on them, things like that. And I think so like those platforms, people are doing research, like independent people are doing research, politicians are always trying to make regulations around it, so it definitely is smart of them to put as much in place to keep people on the platform but not be addicted or not have the mental health toll. And I guess, I mean, there's ways of addicting people, so there should be ways of fixing those things too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it definitely makes sense.
Yeah, and it's not like the tobacco companies were like, yeah, we're going to stick a fat warning label on our cartons, you know? Like, that all came because we as a collective did the research and we're like, yo, these are bad for you. Like, yeah. Well, the science is not unclear here.
I think, I think when that happened, it was a much different time. Like, news didn't spread as much or as quickly, or it was easy to tell people, no, it doesn't. Yeah. It's not, like, what studies, right? Those are false, whatever. But now with the internet, it's like any scientists, any organization can put something out and make it big news, and it's super easy. So nowadays it's much easier for an industry to not be able to hide the effects of their products.
And also, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, that's very true, but there's still the hurdle of getting through, like, lobbyists in Washington. You know,
you're right.
Big tech lobbyists is one of the most influential groups in our country.
Yeah.
Besides the pharmaceutical lobbying.
Right.
So, you know, we could, somebody could come out tomorrow and be like, and they have, you know, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook and these social media platforms are bad for you. You know, maybe okay in moderation. But at the end of the day, you know, Facebook wants to go, listen, Ted Cruz, here's some money to like, make sure this does not pass.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's always going to be a hard battle.
I guess Jewel didn't have good enough lobbyists.
Yeah, Jewel did not want to shell out the big bucks. No. Their margins were too small. So what were you going to say, though?
I don't know. I forgot, actually, but that's okay. I think it was along the lines of something, you know, we're all just trying to figure this out. Right. And like in moderation, like you guys said, like, I think that's at least the best approach to most things. Mm-hmm. I think it's sometimes hard to figure out where that line is, right? Where that line is between like, I'm using too much or I'm moderating or I'm not doing enough, you know. I think a balance, like, you know, with anything, it's like, but it's like knowing that, right? And how what is too much, right? So
tell me, I think that I've been wanting to ask this all podcast long, but I figured towards the end might be the best place to ask it. If one is experiencing mental health issues, quote unquote, you know, depression, anxiety, thoughts of self-harm, what is the easiest and best way to seek help in therapy?
In therapy or just like overall?
Well, let's start with the first step. What would somebody do if they were, you know, feeling thoughts of depression? What could they do to, what's the first step to seeking help?
First step is seeking help. I mean, know your protect, like, supports, right? What are the things that are going to help you? And like, some people may not have supports, right? Some people may not have a family member they can turn to. Some people may not have a neighbor. But there's gotta be someone in your life, whoever it could be, that you could reach out to. And if you don't, you know, there are programs out there. 988 is the National Suicide Hotline. Now, I'm glad it's a 3-digit number now.
Yeah.
988. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was
1-800 something.
Right.
Something.
Logic did a song that had the number in it and about the suicide hotline. And shortly, I think maybe 2 years ago, it changed to 988. And that's, you know, that's the national hotline now. If you need help, like, someone will reach, you know, pick up. Mm-hmm. There's also other, you know, things out there, like for kids who maybe not want to call, they can text. Like crisis text line, like that kind of organization, like that will,
is it the same thing? They can text 988.
They can text 988 actually, but also like, crisis text line is text based only. And,
should we look that up? So we can, you relay text, the number.
You text the word home to 741-741.
Okay. 741-741.
Yeah. And that'll connect you with like a volunteer mm-hmm. who has been trained in mental health, and they'll text you within like a 45-minute window. Like you mm-hmm. can talk to them for like 45 minutes just texting yeah. back and forth. So,
and they can maybe give some other resources that may help them in their situation.
Absolutely. But like the first step, like if you're, you know, if you're having thoughts of suicide, like reach out, it's mm-hmm. okay. Like people to talk about it, you know, people like in our culture, it kind of feels very taboo to talk about like suicide or depression. And studies have shown that talking about suicide is not going to convince the person of completing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It's actually more of a relief for mm-hmm. people to actually talk about their thoughts of wanting to kill themselves
mm-hmm.
or their plan, you know? And that is actually a preventative measure, right, mm-hmm. of actually them completing it. So please, like, don't be afraid to talk to someone who might have thought those thoughts. Talk to them, even if it's just like, you know, just being an ear, just yeah. being someone to listen to who's having those thoughts can help dramatically. So,
and yeah. it doesn't have to be the other person on these hotlines or the text lines. It could be, like you said, a neighbor or somebody that you trust. Maybe it's somebody that you don't trust. I mean, listen, anything's better than the alternative, right? So,
yeah.
And then in terms of seeking therapy, what is the best way to be connected with a therapist?
Best way to be connected with a therapist, this another resource out there is Psychology Today.
Okay.
Psychology Today is .com. Is a great, you go on there, you can find therapists who will take your insurance. Like you can filter through options in your area, whether you want online or not, the type of therapy, in terms of like what else, if you want like male or female, mm-hmm. like it's a great resource to narrow down like what you're looking for in a therapist. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, and also if you have health insurance, most health insurances nowadays, I don't know if it's all, maybe there's some kind of regulation, but most of them will offer some kind of free mental health support. So you don't even have to pay a copay. Like I know United Health always advertised, I forget the name of theirs, but it was like free. You can talk to someone. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
there's yeah. that too. Reach out, find what works for you. But the first step is asking for help. So... Yeah. Well, thank you, Shane. I appreciate you speaking with us today. This yeah. was really great, and I'm so happy that we got you on, and it's a long time coming. And I hope your journey becoming a licensed therapist and thereafter is one that that is a good experience. And I know working with inmates may be a little tough at times, but if I know anything about you, you're resilient and you can do it. And I'm really looking forward to speaking again to see what that journey looks like.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks. Been a pleasure.
And thanks for listening, guys. Of course, follow us on Instagram and YouTube and all of the other socials. Just don't over-follow us, okay? Moderation of the use, okay?
Yeah. Don't cope with us.
Until next time, y'all. We'll be here every 2 weeks. Thanks for listening, and good night.
Good bed.